HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Calculating Race, Racial Discrimination in Risk Assessment by Benjamin Wiggins, read by Eric Jason Martin. Introduction: Racial Formation in the Risk Society. In the summer of 1776, colonists on the Danish Gold Coast, present-day Ghana, had fallen into a series of conflicts with the nearby Dutch settlers. When Captain Peleg Clark arrived with the slave ship Thames at Christiansborg Castle in Accra, he found that, as a result of the battles, the Danes had ceased all trade. Unable to collect on his contract, Clark anchored his vessel and awaited reconciliation between the Danes and the Dutch so that he could finally receive the payment he was owed. But not all progress for the ship had halted. As the months passed, the Thames began to accumulate more and more human cargo, filling its hold with enslaved Africans to take to market at its ultimate destination of Montego Bay, Jamaica. On the afternoon of November 8th, nearly 3 months into its stranding at Accra, crew members unchained the 160 enslaved persons on board in order to let them wash. While the ship's crew would usually have returned the enslaved persons to their deck chains shortly after they bathed, the captain who typically oversaw that activity went ashore before the washing concluded. Three of the ship's sailors had gone swimming that morning, and the captain set out to return the party. With only three white crew members remaining on board and free of their deck chains, the enslaved persons seized an opportunity to win back their freedom. After wounding the bosun on the main deck, the enslaved persons attempted to gain control of the ship from the remaining two whites, the doctor and the carpenter. Despite outnumbering the white crew by more than a factor of 50, the enslaved persons on board were still limited by their shackles and were trapped on the main deck. The doctor and carpenter had the advantage of their position on the bridge, which was protected by a heavy barricade. While some of the enslaved persons worked to down the barricade, others pelted the bridge with staves and billets of wood. When these efforts failed, dozens of the enslaved men began to jump overboard in an effort to scale the ship and reach the bridge. The leeward current was so strong, however, that few could even stay near the ship. Eventually, the doctor and carpenter fired muskets loaded only with powder to intimidate those who remained aboard. And when the rest of the crew returned from shore, they collected the six enslaved persons who had managed to stay afloat for the better part of 2 hours, despite the weight of their shackles and the strong current. "When all was a little settled," wrote the doctor, "we found 32 men and men boys with 2 women a-missing, the best slaves we had." As a result of the Danish-Dutch conflict and this uprising, Clark created a unique document entitled A Copy of Account of Their Monthly Expense of Ship Thames and Damages Sent the Dean's Company at Accra. Sent to the local Danish government on December 27th, the ledger detailed the monthly expenses of the Thames since its arrival at the outpost and demanded restitution for the losses it incurred over the 4 months the Danes had neglected to pay their contract. Included in Clark's account was a request for £850 for the loss of 36 slaves during the insurrection. More curiously, though, Clark sought not only reimbursement for the slaves lost in the insurrection, but also reimbursement for the risk of mortality and insurrection of 220 slaves, value £9,000, steg at 5 per count, is per month. In demanding repayment for this final line item, Clark sought to have the Danes pay for both the loss of his slaves during the insurrection and for the £37.10 per month premium the ship incurred for its insurance against such loss of human cargo. That the Thames carried such insurance was not unique. A formal system of British marine insurance dates to at least 1688, and the underwriting of the safe passage of ships by businessmen in Edward Lloyd's coffee house in London, which would become Lloyd's of London. And as the human cargo of enslaved persons dominated the shipping industry of the time, people were regularly insured as property in the course of the transatlantic slave trade. While references to maritime slave insurance abound in the documents of the trade, records relating to the policies themselves are rare. Beyond the smattering of disputed claims that resulted in extensive court proceedings, The scarce historical record makes it difficult to understand insurers and slavers' mundane thinking about the practice of insuring property who were yet human beings. In one line, however, Clark's description of his maritime slave insurance premium offers us insight into what it meant to insure human beings as mere objects. In referring to his premium as a way to purchase protection against both the risk of mortality and insurrection, Clark's account reveals that while maritime slave insurance offered security against the loss of the ship's property, this property was also human, and possessing such humanity, enslaved persons were both at risk and a risk. Unlike other cargo, enslaved persons were susceptible to the risks that threatened life on the sea. Mortality coverage recognized that enslaved persons were a special sort of cargo at risk from disease, starvation, exposure, drowning, and all the other maladies and mayhem capable of taking life in the brutal environment of the 18th-century slave ship. Insurrection coverage, likewise, recognized a different aspect of enslaved persons' humanity, their agency. Just as this cargo was at risk, it was also a risk, insofar as the agential personhood of each parcel afforded it the special potential to rise up and threaten the crew, the ship, and the voyage itself. In underwriting the unique risks that threatened this cargo and the risks that this cargo threatened, maritime slave insurance established a complex relationship between enslaved Africans and risk even before they came to the Americas. Loaded dice. Nearly 250 years later, African Americans' complicated relationship to risk persists. In Ta-Nehisi Coates's 2015 memoir, Between the World and Me, the writer observes that, as a black man in the United States, he is part of an equation. This American equation constructs him as a risk. The supposed danger he poses by dint of the color of his skin and the kink of his hair makes him more likely to get stopped and questioned by police, more restrained in how he can move his body, and more restricted in where he can make his home. The construction of his race as a risk also puts him and other African Americans at risk, as they, like Eric Garner, Renisha McBride, or John Crawford, may be killed by law enforcement officers for such innocuous actions as selling a cigarette, seeking help, or shopping in a store. The American equation does not restrict all possibility, to be sure. Some of us make it out, he writes as he reflects on his journey from Baltimore to Paris. But the game, life for African Americans in the contemporary United States, is played with loaded dice. It's telling that Coates uses the metaphors of equations and dice to vividly convey the entangled history of race, chance, and statistics. In his now seminal The Case for Reparations, Coates wrote pointedly about statistical racism in the Federal Housing Administration's, FHA's, ratings of neighborhood risk in their mortgage insurance decisions. But even as Coates and others occasionally zero in on specific sites and institutions in which risk is statistically assessed along racial lines, no study has fully captured the disturbingly sustained and multifaceted use of race as a significant variable in actuarial science, the probabilistic mathematics of risk assessment. Calculating race, racial discrimination in risk assessment, seeks to correct this oversight in the historical understanding of the relationship between risk assessment and race. By tracing how ostensibly objective actuarial formulas have not simply reflected an inequitable distribution of risk along racial lines, but actually have also played a significant role in perpetuating racial disparities in wealth, incarceration, and housing in the United States, I show that constructions of people of color as risks compound the burden of risk that they must bear. In Calculating Race, I investigate the three most significant sites in which race and actuarial science have historically intertwined: insurance, criminology, and housing. I begin with a study of the use of race in the life insurance industry in the last quarter of the 19th century, focusing particularly on the Prudential Life Insurance Company of America and their aggressive battles with state regulators to discriminate against clients and set rates on the basis of race. I then turn my focus to the collection of racial statistics in the Illinois State Penitentiary System in the late 19th century, and the state's subsequent development of predictive sentencing and parole formulas in the 1920s that weighed race as a key factor. Next, I investigate the role of race in the state-sponsored mortgage insurance program of the Federal Housing Administration between the start of the New Deal and the beginning of the Cold War, and its prolonged effects on mortgage lending. In my final chapter, I analyze the use of race in statistical risk assessments in the post-civil rights movement era, and find proxy variables standing in for the now-taboo category of race, and bringing race into 21st-century calculations of risk. It is well established that significant gaps in wealth, incarceration, and homeownership exist between the racial groups of the United States, with whites at the top and blacks, Latinx, and indigenous peoples at the bottom. However, scholars have not fully grasped the role that risk assessment calculations play in creating and maintaining such disparities. Calculating race expands our understanding of racial disparities in the United States by recounting how people of color were constructed as a risk and at risk. It illustrates how, as industry and government strove to base policy on objective data and sound mathematics, they read evidence of racial disparities as evidence of racial inferiority, and in that miscalculation, advanced racialized structural violence. Racial formation in the risk society. The emergence of a science of risk assessment not so coincidentally paralleled the emergence of a science of race. The concept of risk, from the French risque, developed some 4 centuries ago in conjunction with the advent of mercantile capitalism as a way to denote the unpredictable perils of the sea. The concept of race, from the Spanish raza, contemporaneously developed as a way to explain physical differences, as transportation, trade, colonization, and slavery brought diverse populations into closer proximity than ever before. As the 19th century progressed, risk and race both developed into objects of scientific study, and then fields of study, probability and eugenics, respectively, in their own right. And in the young nation of the United States, these fields moved from the academic realm to applied practice, converging in actuarial formulas that held no reservations about utilizing the predictive power of racial statistics. In order to understand this development and intersection of risk and race, we must first understand how race functions. For this, we can turn to the theory of racial formation developed by historical sociologists Michael Omi and Howard Wynant. The work of Omi and Wynant illustrated how race is not simply socially constructed, but is also at heart a dynamic concept that has been continually made and remade. "Our theory of racial formation," wrote Omi and Wynant, "emphasizes the social nature of race, the absence of any essential racial characteristics, the historical flexibility of racial meanings and categories, the conflictual character of race at both the micro and macro social levels, and the irreducible political aspect of racial dynamics." It is an essential framework for historians of race to understand the contextually dependent nature and resiliency of the concept, and it is a framework I utilize throughout this work. To gain a new understanding of the history of race, however, we must investigate the process of racial formation within the context of what another set of historical sociologists have termed the risk society. Across 3 decades of research, Ulrich Beck and Anthony Giddens made a compelling case that the assessment and management of risk is the fundamental organizing force in modernity. Treating modern society as a risk society, as they did, I illustrate that risk assessment is not limited to insurance, but rather grows to pervade decision-making processes throughout industry, government, and even to an extent, the everyday life of individuals. By placing the theoretical framework of racial formation against the backdrop of the risk society, this work adds to an emergent sector of business history that investigates alternative histories of capitalism. Building on the scholarship of Jonathan Levy, Thomas Piketty, Sven Beckert, Michael Ralph, Dinah Barry, and Christine Desson, It rejects the traditionally neat split between state and industry, studies an expanded set of economic actors, focuses on the development of systems of thought that produced the deep entanglement between racism and wealth, and positions this American history within a global network of material and intellectual exchange. Additionally, this work contributes connective tissue to the disparate scholarship that has already found important links between risk and race in America's past. The academic critique of racial bias in actuarial science began near the beginning of the nefarious practice. Sociologists W.E.B. Du Bois and Kelly Miller each wrote scathing critiques of Prudential's discriminatory race-based policy premiums as early as 1896. More recently, articles and chapters from Beatrix Hoffman, Mary Heen, J. Gabriel McGlamory, and Dan Bauck have kickstarted the historical scholarship on racial discrimination in life insurance. But given the pervasiveness and lengthy duration of the racial discrimination in life insurance, much remains to be discussed. Likewise, Bernard Harcourt has covered some of the history of actuarial science that utilizes race in sentencing and parole decisions. However, neither Harcourt nor others have sufficiently charted the practice's dependency on the big data before big data that was the Bertillon system of classification. And though the racially discriminatory policies of the FHA are well known, thanks to contributions from Isaac Groner, David Helfeld, Kenneth Jackson, Amy Hillier, Jennifer Light, and Chloe Thurston, none of this scholarship has placed the agency's practices in the context of racialized risk assessment practices of its time, or shown its relationship to the actuarial turn United States businesses had begun to take by the time of the New Deal era. Finally, my work on anti-discrimination law and proxies for race represents a novel trajectory in historical scholarship, one that is made retroactively possible only through field-altering work on algorithmic bias from statisticians and computer scientists, such as the scholars behind the Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency in Machine Learning, FATML, workshop, and the Association of Computing Machinery's Conference on Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency, ACM-FAT. Of course, even as calculating race contributes to our understanding of the history of racial injustice in the United States, its perspective is a limited and imperfect one. At its core, it is a history of a system of thought. Relying primarily on archival documents from corporations, state governments, and the federal government, calculating race is an American history from above. It studies the policies and practices that engendered a dominant discourse that linked people of color with risk, first by constructing them as inherent risks, and subsequently by further entrenching the racism-fueled disparities already present in wealth, incarceration, and housing. In focusing on the development of these policies and practices in industry and government, it concentrates only occasionally on the people affected by these policies and practices. Moreover, as a history of discriminatory policies of industry and government in the racist and sexist periods of the late 19th and early to mid-20th centuries, the book largely focuses on white men seeking, at least implicitly, to maintain the supremacy of whites in American society. As such, the voices of people of color and women are not foregrounded. While at points calculating race shows how people of color creatively resisted actuarial discourses that constructed them as naturally inferior, there is much further work that could be done to showcase the rich history of dissent against the racialization of risk, as well as the intersection between risk assessment and other categories of difference such as sex and gender. It is my hope that this history provides some grounding for additional endeavors along these lines. Chapter 1. Life. On a Tuesday evening in the winter of 1912, executives of the Prudential Insurance Company of America made the chilly three-block walk from the company's Newark headquarters down Broad Street to El Octel Stetter's restaurant. The Prudential Athletic Association, a fraternal organization the company's male employees could join for $1 per year, had rented the eatery's dining room for the night to host a lavish seven-course meal. As the businessmen took their seats, each was greeted with a detailed program of the night's festivities. A coal-black face with exaggerated crimson lips stared at diners from the earth-toned leaflet. These insurance men gathered that evening to celebrate our minstrels. Since at least April of that year, the club had been rehearsing a chorus of 50 of its members, accompanied by a number of end men who had already established themselves in New Jersey's amateur minstrelsy scene. As the audience feasted on capon and halibut, the chorus donned black faces of burnt cork and treated their peers to the sounds of ditties that boasted the grandeur of the Old South, such as Come On, Lisa. The troupe even offered its audience an original song entitled Hello, Prudential Town, a number lamenting the blackface performer's position as the entertainment, wishing aloud to be down there with all the boys and ladies fair. The scene at the diner reduced African Americans to a one-dimensional caricature, though the performance was not out of step with the times. And Prudential's quasi-sponsorship of the event was hardly unique. In 1910, for instance, a benefit for the Insurance Society of New York featured an amateur minstrel show performing a sketch called The Darktown Insurance Investigation. The racist caricatures in L. Octel Stetter's dining room that night were so pervasive at the time that the minstrelsy of these Prudential employees is historically unremarkable. There is, however, quite a remarkable history of racism and insurance. This tale does not center on the extracurricular activities of life insurance executives by night, but rather on the activities of insurance companies during the business day. While the blackface performance of the Prudential Athletic Association perpetuated a by-then-mundane form of racism, the calculations made at the desks of Prudential's headquarters between the late 19th century and the first half of the 20th broke a path for a novel form of racial discrimination. In the spreadsheets of the company's statisticians and actuaries, people of color became disassociated from their personhood and translated into numerical representations of risk. Of course, people of color in the United States have had their personhood statistically undermined previously for centuries, the three-fifths compromise being the most vivid example. And even whites had their lives broken up into data and reduced to a few numbers representing the likelihood of an early death or their potential to succumb to an accident. However, Prudential and their peers' calculations in the last quarter of the 19th century were different. In industrial life insurers' formulas, people of color were stripped not only of their personhood, but also of their history. Insuring race. Prudential was the first life insurer to regularly insure people of color as people rather than as chattel in the United States. From its founding as the Prudential Friendly Society in 1875, the company took an approach to life insurance that diverged radically from its peers. Rather than avoid the industrial workers that its competitors unanimously deemed too dangerous to insure, Prudential sought them out. The company offered policies to laborers throughout America's industrial trades. These policies paid out enough to cover funerary expenses and left a small additional sum to surviving kin for a mere 3 pennies a week. Within months of its founding, Prudential had a deluge of customers. Between 1876, its first full year of existence, and the end of the decade, the young company's assets grew 50-fold. Prudential was also unique in its position as a northern company. Southern insurers had long been cognizant of race. Some even built their companies on insuring enslaved persons as property, and after emancipation, unsurprisingly, insurers in the South systematically refused to take on any African Americans as people in life policies. Prudential, it seems, never considered that it might garner black clientele and had no standard to refuse the acceptance of African Americans. This lack of racial exclusions, however, was not necessarily a progressive move on the company's part. In the 1870s North, African Americans were simply not a major issue for any life insurers. Though many northern life insurers also underwrote policies on enslaved persons as property in the antebellum period, their life policies were so prohibitively expensive that they priced out the majority of even the white population. Since the average African American in 1870 possessed 2.5 cents of wealth for every dollar of wealth the average white owned, only a handful of blacks had the means to even inquire about coverage. In Prudential's initial mortality tables, it either did not separate whites from African Americans or did not enumerate African Americans in their population data. Since the company did not distinguish African Americans from the rest of the population and restrict them from purchasing coverage, blacks purchased life policies in droves. At a time when few investments were open to African Americans, the 3 pennies blacks gave to Prudential agents each week represented a small bit of confidence in a social world that systematically deprived them of security. Soon, however, Prudential came to realize that blacks made up a significant number of its policyholders. An official history of the company published in 1900 recounts the matter. Thus far, Negroes had not seriously been considered as applicants for industrial insurance, but with the increasing extent of the business, the colored population had also become increasingly interested and was now in increasing numbers availing itself of this opportunity to provide for the contingencies of life. Unlike the Southern insurers, who thought it unnecessary to justify their unequivocal refusal to sell to African-American clients, Prudential found it necessary to conduct a statistical study of the mortality of African-Americans. Unsurprisingly, the company's 1881 survey by race found that Negro insured lives, most of whom had recently lived in the miserable conditions of chattel slavery, and many of whom were now living in the equally miserable conditions of debt peonage, experienced mortality rates about 50% higher than among whites. With the numbers to demonstrate the inferior vitality of African Americans, in April of 1881, Prudential made the decision to drop benefits by 1/3 for black adults and increase premiums for black infants from 3 cents per week to 5. However, company executives felt that even the benefit drop and premium increase was not enough to dissuade black business. That July, Leon Blanchard, the superintendent of Prudential's Philadelphia region, issued orders that no agent will be allowed to take more than 20% of colored business. And weeks later, Blanchard's regional office began to simply refuse premiums from blacks, refund them, and lapse their policies. While this shift to a racialized, two-tiered system of coverage represented just a few dollars of indemnity, it also represented something larger. It signified an emergent entanglement of actuarial science and race. Exercising excess mortality. Prudential's decision to cut benefits for African-American adults and increase premiums for African-American infants signaled how the insurance industry would treat its relationship to racism in the country's past. The original study Prudential used to justify its decision to move to race-based pricing does not survive. However, published references confirm that it was statistical in nature and drew on data collected for a large number of American cities. Furthermore, from these references, we know that it is likely that the study took into account northern and southern cities. What the study did not take into account were any social conditions. It statistically proved the inequality in morbidity and mortality between whites and people of color, but it did not correct for inequities in medical care, law, housing, environment, economic opportunity, or education. It did not address the histories of genocide, slavery, or indentured servitude that plagued people of color throughout the history of the United States. A memorandum from John F. Dryden, then Prudential's secretary and soon to be its president, addressed to Prudential's superintendents and agents, needed only one line of text to justify the decision to differentiate benefits and pricing by race. It read, "These changes are made in consequence of the excessive mortality prevailing in the class named above." To Prudential, such a disparity was simply a fact, the circumstances behind which were of no interest to the company. Prudential had found an actuarial shortcut to mitigate its risk and maximize its profit. And so did Prudential's peers. In July of 1879, John Hancock Mutual Life Insurance Company began writing industrial life insurance, selling 9,327 policies that year. And in November of 1879, Metropolitan Life Insurance Company began writing industrial policies too, underwriting 213,878 such policies across the next 2 years. Two dozen more insurers would write industrial policies before the 20th century, but as Mary Heen noted, the big three of Prudential, John Hancock, and Metropolitan made up 95% of this business. Like Prudential, Metropolitan had not thought to racially restrict their initial offering of industrial insurance and ended up with a significant number of black clientele. But within months of Prudential's decision to differentiate rates for African Americans, Metropolitan stopped issuing policies to blacks. It, too, justified its decision through statistics, expressing
Sample complete. Ready to continue?